morning, everyone. I am Rob Atkinson. I'm president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. I want to welcome you to an event where we're releasing a new report today, The Need for Speed, the Importance of Next Generation Broadband Networks. And we will adjourn at 11:30 today, but, excuse me, 11:15, my apologies. And so what we'll do is I wanted to just take a minute and introduce the panelists we have, and then I'll make a few remarks, turn it over to my colleague and lead author of the report, Stephen Ezell, and then Tom Galvin, who is president of 463 Communications, is going to moderate the discussion we have, and then we should have at least 15 minutes for Q&A. So let me start by introducing folks. I'll start with Stephen Ezell in the middle here. Stephen is a senior analyst at ITIF. He is, as I said, the lead author of the report. Before that, he was a founder of a business consulting firm called Peer Insight that focused on principally on services innovation. Jeff, you're over here. To Jeff Campbell over on my far right. Jeff is senior director technology and trade policy at Cisco Systems. He has been there since 2001, where he helps develop and implement Cisco's public policy agenda with regard to telecommunications, trade, security, and technology. He's also a board member of the California Emerging Technologies Fund, the Family Online Safety Institute, and the Voice on the Net Coalition. Prior to that, Jeff was head of the Washington Government Affairs Office for Compaq Computer and began his career as a telecom regulatory attorney in D.C. at Squire, Sanford, and Dempsey. To my immediate right is Chris Vane. Chris is the CIO of the City of San Francisco, and in that capacity, he provides policy guidance on the city's technology vision. Provides telecom and IT services to city departments, and he guides the city's technology and cable television franchise policies. Before he became CIO, he was Associate Vice President of Operations at SAIC, and he began his career working in the Executive Office of the President in three different administrations, Reagan, Bush, and Clinton. Unfortunately, while we had sent out notice that Joaquin Alvarado, who's the director of the Institute for Next Generation Internet, was going to join us. He was actually here in town, and unfortunately last night he had to head back to California on a personal business that was an emergency, so unfortunately he won't join us. And if we'd had next generation high speed, high def video conferencing, we could have had Joaquin join us, but as I'll explain in a minute, we didn't. On my far left is John Windhausen. John is president of Telopoly Consulting, and he's worked in the communications policy area in Washington for over 20 years. He began his career as a staff attorney at the FCC in '84, moved to Capitol Hill in '87, serving as counsel and then senior counsel to Senator Hollings and Senator Inouye. And he's probably best known for being one of the lead architects of the 96 Telecom Act, but he also helped draft in the 92 Cable Act and the 93 Spectrum Auction Act. He joined the Competition Policy Institute as general counsel in '89, and he became president of the Association of Local Telecommunications Services in 1999. And then in 2004, he opened the consulting practice. Right on my immediate left is Tom Galvin, who is a partner and founder of 463 Communications. Tom, 463 provides media and communications advice and guidance to clients around a set of strategic communications goals. Prior to that, Tom was Vice President of Government Relations at VeriSign. He was also creator of Washington, D.C. Communications Office for Cisco, worked with Cisco's public relations team. He's also spent over a decade as a political journalist, participating in more than 10,000 interviews with 1,000 newsmakers, including working as a correspondent for Congressional Quarterly and the New York Daily News. So I just want to make a few opening remarks, and then I'll turn it over to my colleague, Stephen. a couple of opening remarks. One is, you know, it was actually a lot harder to do this report than we thought it was going to be. We thought, okay, everybody talks about next-gen broadband. Everybody understands how important it is. There must be a lot of analytical work out there on what's going on and why it's, what's happening and why. And it turns out there really wasn't as much as we thought. So what we tried to do in this report is put together in one place an analysis and if you will, compendium of what we think the interesting and important applications and why next-gen broadband is going to be a transformative technology. You know, this is a little bit like, when you think about this debate, there's sort of three or four arguments that people make, if you will, to say we can just sort of rely on the status quo, that everything's fine right now. Why are you pushing this big vision for a transformative broadband system? One is essentially that 5 megabits is enough. You know, we can all do what we need to do on 5 megs. I can download some YouTube videos and I can do my emails. Why do you need more? And I guess the answer is essentially, we have always been able to find and use transformative uses for increases in processing power, computing power, storage, and communications. So the history of the IT industry has always been one where people have said, we've got enough now, but as more capabilities come online, a whole set of new things come about that people couldn't just simply envision. And I don't see that there's any evidence that that's any different today. And I think we simply cannot imagine what is going to happen in 5 or 10 years if we are getting much higher speed networks. We simply can't imagine those kinds of applications. And I think for us to simply to say, well, we're okay where we are, is really, at the end of the day, a relatively pessimistic view of the world. It's in saying, well, we don't need to have any more progress. And I think that's fundamentally wrong. The second argument you hear, and some people like to say this, is, well, we don't need any higher speed networks because people are just going to sit there and watch video. I won't say what kind of video they say they're watching, but you sort of get the message. Absolutely, people are going to watch video. It's not a crime. It's actually entertaining. But there's so much more that people will do with these networks, and that's what Stephen will show today. So yes, of course, people are going to do it for entertainment. Although, as I said, that's in some ways, entertainment is an important thing, and it helps people have better lives. But they will do it for a lot more than that. The last argument people make: well, you know, it's all well and good, but we'll get there. Why are you all pushing on this? Why don't you just sort of let the market get there on its own sweet time? And to be sure, the market is moving in that direction. We see companies like Verizon rolling out fiber optic to the home, AT&T with its U-verse, Comcast with DOCSIS 3, a rollout of 4G, LTE, and WiMAX. But the real issue there is that going to be fast enough? And if you look at what some other countries have done, particularly Korea and Japan, I would argue it is not, for the simple reason that there are what economists call network externalities in this technology. So faster networks don't get deployed because people feel they don't need them, and they don't need them because there isn't as much to do on them. And so you have this chicken or egg issue where I think public policy can make a clear key role. One example of that is one of the things we tried to do was to actually have a live demo where we were going to do a high def video teleconference with San Francisco. I can't tell you how hard that was. It was so hard that we ended up not doing it. And so we asked a lot of people to help us, and they were trying to help, and it just became logistically impossible for us to do that. That tells us something, that if you want to do something simple here in the nation's capital, to just simply do a high-def video, we could have done it if we'd gone out to a university, but I feel like we need to be downtown and we didn't want to go all the way out to university. We can't easily do this. It suggests that we do have this chicken or egg challenge. So I think with that, in our view, there's a real compelling need to have this as a vision. I'm not sure it's going to be what we're going to do in the next year or so with the stimulus, but it certainly needs to be the next step after that as how we think about moving next generation networks in America. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague Stephen, who will review the findings of the report.
Thank you, Rob. So I think there are four key summary findings from the report. And the first is that deploying next-generation broadband internet will enable the emergence of a whole host of online applications and services that will increase quality of life and boost economic growth. And really, the true potential of the next generation broadband network lies in the transformative new functionalities it enables. So it's not just about the faster speeds and the higher bandwidth capacity. It is that those attributes allow fundamentally new functionalities and applications to come onto the market that will be very transformative. And the applications that will run on the next generation broadband network will be woven into the daily fabric of life, transforming how Americans live, work, learn, and play. When you think about the very serious social challenges our nation confronts in terms of education, healthcare, transportation, environmental management, the applications that can run over next generation broadband networks give us the ability to deal with these very challenging social issues in entirely new, novel, and innovative ways. And I think it's very wonderful that we have Chris Veen, the CIO of the City of San Francisco, here today to give us a sense in some of the things San Francisco is doing with the Connected Urban Development Initiative about how they intend to use next-generation networks to deal with some very serious social and governmental challenges. Finally, here and forth, the United States does not currently have sufficient speeds to make the vision of the next generation internet a reality. Now, this is not simply and solely about complaining that the United States is behind the leading countries in the world in broadband speed. Now, certainly that's the case. Average U.S. broadband speeds are less than 5 megabits per second downstream and 0.5 Mbps upstream. Now, in the report, we go through and get methodical and cite a number of studies, and some say the average U.S. broadband speed is 4.9 megabits per second. That's from the OECD in 2007. A study by the Communication Workers of America of delivered broadband speeds in the United States in August 2008 said that, well, the average speed that gets delivered to the American consumer is 2.35 megabytes per second. And the upstream speeds they enjoy are only 0.435 megabits per second, so 435 kilobits. Wherever the actual number stands, I think we're on safe ground to say that U.S. speeds are less than 5 megabits per second. And when you put that in an international context, next to the speeds that citizens enjoy in Japan, 63 Mbps, South Korea, 49 Mbps, it's safe to say we're considerably behind the speeds that citizens in the leading countries in the world enjoy. Another point here is that we're just not behind those countries in terms of speeds, but we risk falling further behind the broadband technology frontier. So communications power doubles every 20 months. So we have a continuing process of technology, meaning we can deliver faster broadband speeds. So this puts us all on notice that, you know, as a policy objective, we're going to be needing to keep focused on making the broadband speeds that technology can deliver a reality for our citizens. But as I said, it's not solely that we're behind these other countries. What the story is really about is that the current speeds we have are inadequate to support individual specific next generation online services. So when we look at standard definition digital television, which is going to require 4 Mbps to deliver. When we look at video conferencing, just basic high definition video conferencing is going to require 1.2 to 4 Mbps. To Rob's point, our own office building only had 1.5 Mbps on a T1 connection. That's why we couldn't do the video conference there. That's causing us actually to move to a new location 3 months from now, because as ITIF, we have to have at least 10 to 20 Mbps into our offices. High definition digital television, or IPTV, Internet Protocol Television. This is television that is delivered over the internet. It's going to require at least 8 Mbps and probably 15 Mbps for the high definition television. Telepresencing. This is a video conferencing on a very sophisticated basis where you have three screens on both sides and you are doing a video conference in a very immersive, high-fidelity environment that makes participants feel like they are actually in the same room together, that's going to require 15 megabits per second. So even to support individual applications, we're going to need very high-speed next-generation networks. But it's not just about supporting those applications. The fact of the matter is that consumers will demand the ability to use a multiplicity of these applications simultaneously from the home. So it is not a stretch at all to imagine a family of the near future where you have mom engaged in a video conference for her home business, where dad is watching a college football game over the internet. The two kids are at home studying. One is participating in distance education or online learning. Another is giving a presentation over the internet. The average home today contains 25 to 30 electronic devices. All these will be connecting to the internet, looking to share data, and this multiplicity of applications and devices will be another factor driving the need for next generation broadband networks. So really, what we're talking about here is a transformative paradigm shift. If you think back to how the world evolved when we simply went from 56 kbps dial-up speeds to the very first generation of broadband, to the 1.5 Mbps speeds, that wasn't simply about going to an always-on environment, but even that incremental jump in speeds allowed us to use a range of new applications via a voice-over internet protocol, blogging, podcasting, getting travel directions online, using geographic information systems. So just as we experienced a paradigm shift as we moved from dial-up to first-generation broadband networks, so we're going to see a paradigm shift as we move from current generation to next-generation networks and see the new applications that they enable. I said there were four transformative functionalities enabled by next-generation broadband, and we would see those as dramatically faster file transfer speeds for both uploads and downloads, the ability to transmit streaming video, the means to engage in true real-time collaboration, and ultimately, the ability to use all of these functionalities simultaneously. So first, broadband benefits consumers by enabling faster file transfers. Now, this just isn't about uploading or downloading pictures faster or getting your YouTube video faster. This is truly transformative because faster upload speeds empower more consumers to be content producers and distributors. So at the average 0.435 upload speeds of today, if you have 10 minutes of video that you've created at home and you want to post to the internet, that can take up to 4.5 hours. It's just not practical. Over next generation networks, uploading 10 minutes worth of video would take about 12 minutes. Well, why is that important? Well, look at a firm like Global Scholar, which has been called the most ambitious education portal in the entire world. What Global Scholar allows you to do is create online training or tutorial videos of areas in which you have special expertise. Maybe you're good at taking the ACT or the SAT. You can create your own videos of teaching students how to take these classes, tutoring them in math, science, English. Global Scholar has 1,500 of these individual tutors who have created their own videos, and students around the country buy them and get tutored and learn this way. Well, that's astounding. Think about the potential that is unlocked when we're able to create not an eBay for services, when the internet gives us the ability to unleash our knowledge, our skills, our expertise online through video. That's fundamentally transformative. We'll create new companies. Of course, video on demand, downloading movies faster will certainly be the case. You'd be able to download a feature-length DVD movie in under 15 minutes as opposed to about 4 hours today. Faster file transfers also enable cloud computing, which allows individuals to store data and applications remotely instead of on their laptop or their desktop, and this can be a transformative paradigm shift. Next generation internet is also transformative in enabling video streaming applications. I mentioned Internet Protocol Television. This is delivery of the TV over the internet. IPTV is a wonderful application because it brings increased competition to the television marketplace. It creates new use cases. It can make watching television interactive. You can click over, if you're watching a television show, say Sex and the City, and you like the outfit Carrie Bradshaw is wearing, with IPTV, you can actually click on her character, see the outfit she's wearing, and even buy it online right then and there. So it creates new business models online. IPTV is so powerful that ABI Research predicts that it will soon overtake cable or satellite-delivered television as the most viewed channel for watching television in the entire world. Third, next-generation broadband fundamentally enables real-time collaborations. So it unlocks the ability to telecommute from home, because now you can not only have a larger bandwidth pipe to the home, which means you're able to transfer more data files, do a whole new range of tasks and services from home that you couldn't do before, like working with engineering, CAD, drafting documents. But it allows you to engage in video conferencing more readily because you'll have the speeds to do the video conferencing. A study from the Fiber to the Home Council found that in communities where fiber optic cable has been deployed, it actually quadrupled the amount of time that users spent telecommuting from the home. That's profound in its ability to support telecommuting. Of course, telepresence is found in a number of locations. Here we see a picture of doctors actually watching a surgery in the operating room via telepresence. So they're watching this live, communicating with the doctors. Below, here's a product development exercise via telepresence where two groups from a company are working on building a product in different locations. This is powerful because essentially, it allows information technology to replace fossil fuels as a means of bringing people together in meetings, and that can have profound impacts on our environment. Finally, I'll just walk through some of the examples in the case study that pertain to healthcare, education, and government, and we're lucky to have Chris and John here who can delve more into that. But with regard to healthcare, next-generation broadband can be absolutely transformative. First, by enabling instantaneous contact between professionals and patients through teleconsultations. So there's a picture of a doctor consulting with colleagues who may have more expertise in the case of delivering a baby. Digital pathology, a remote diagnosis of illness and disease. This is really an incredible application. Japanese doctors are using an NTT delivered system that essentially can take slides of cells looked at under a microscope, deliver them via broadband, and it has gotten to the point where they're actually able to make a definitive diagnosis of cancer via the images of these cells that are delivered over the broadband network. Japan deployed a satellite called Kizuna that provides the entire country high-speed broadband access. And one of the reasons they did that was that so the citizens on the remote islands would be able to participate in teleconsultations with doctors in urban medical centers so that they would be able to receive the best possible medical care. So really an amazing range of applications that broadband can support to transform the delivery of healthcare. Jeff Campbell from Cisco Systems will show an amazing one that's Cisco's Health Translator Network. Likewise with education, and John Windhausen will give you some examples. But next-generation broadband networks have the power to transform how education is delivered. Now, this can, of course, take the form of students. Essentially, think about two case examples. One is a small school district that would like to be able to teach all of its students different languages, like Spanish, Arabic, or Korean, but can't possibly support the number of teachers to teach all those classes, right? Why not just connect your students in the various schools with a video conferencing or a telepresence system, and have one teacher from a central location be able to teach the class to all the students who might reside and be interested in that subject throughout the various campuses of the school district. And so that's the case study. Carnegie Mellon University, Yale, Harvard use classes and lectures delivered via video conferencing to reach all their students at the various campuses around the world. A great example of how next generation networks transform education. Another one is EdCar. This is education digital content management system. So if you think back to when you were in school, and every, you know, once a month you would have film day, where you went into the film projector room and everybody's happy because you could watch the film this day. Well, why isn't that integrated into how we teach our kids every single day? And what EdCar does as a central online repository for digital content assets is give teachers the ability to pull down snippets, clips of digital content that pertains to a subject they're teaching immediately, readily via central online source. So it really transforms how we can deliver education. It enhances the ability to perform research from students to astrophysicists. So whether it's students looking to access resources at the Library of Congress for their report, or whether it's a researcher, a physicist who needs to tap into multi-terabyte data files that are being generated from, say, the data collected at the Large Hadron device in Switzerland that they're working on. The point is, next generation broadband networks allow the bandwidth that very high, large data sets can be transmitted seamlessly over the internet. And, you know, countries like Japan and South Korea see the power of next generation broadband networks to level the playing field for all students and give them equal access to resources and educational opportunities, and they're using it to transform how education is delivered in their countries. Here are just two quick examples. This is a Cisco one in Cleveland, where the Cleveland Metro Parks had a video conference of a live interactive zoo experience. That's the Cleveland Zoo, and they're talking to elementary school kids about the animals of the zoo. Another one with high school students learning from a college chemistry professor. Finally, and I'll leave this more to Chris, but next generation broadband will be transformative in supporting society and government, the delivery of public services, empowering citizens to engage with civic affairs and connect with their government. As more and more communities begin to put a webcast of their town hall meetings online, Obama has said he wants to put all congressional hearings and agency meetings online. We're going to need the power of next generation broadband networks to deliver the video so people can engage in civic affairs. It can help address transportation and environmental challenges as well. One quick point there. We're all aware of these dynamic messaging signs, these variable messaging signs on the roads that tell us, alert, there's a wreck ahead or congestion ahead. Well, in many areas of the country, those messages are actually delivered to those signs via a dial-up connection. And in many cases, the information is already out of date by the time it even arrives at the board. So we need networks to get that information to citizens on a timely basis. And finally, I'll close with just pointing out some of the differences between today's internet and the next generation internet, and what this enhanced capacity is going to give us. You know, today's internet is independent. You download music from all over the world. Next generation internet is going to be collaborative. It's going to allow you to create music with other musicians from all over the world. Today's internet is defined by websites. Tomorrow's will be interactive, virtual worlds, collaborations via video conference and telepresence. Today, we know private resources. We save things to our computer. Tomorrow, we'll be able to save them online and use shared resources, online file servers, and remote devices. As I said earlier, we move from this world of one-to-one or one-to-many communications to a world of many-to-many communication, global scholar, virtual conferences, video conferences, and telepresencing. And finally, ultimately, we move from a low-quality world of lower-quality audio and video to a higher-quality world of high-definition audio and video. So, you know, I think the message is next-generation broadband networks bring transformative functionalities that allow the creation of very innovative, novel applications that will fundamentally transform the quality of life for U.S. citizens and drive economic growth. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Tom Galvin with 463 Communications. Before we start, any of the folks who are standing, if you want to sit down, there's seats. I'll give you a second to know there's over there. My job is to be the moderator, which means you won't hear a lot from me, which if you ask my wife and my colleagues, they say that's a very good thing. And I'm going to introduce the three folks on the panel, and then we'll get to questions. But before we do, I did want to share an experience I had last week. I was taking a flight from Washington to San Francisco on Virgin America. And they happened to have wireless connections on the plane, which was actually the first time I'd had that. So I hooked onto it and was able to get some work done on email and everything. I'm like, oh, maybe I'll watch a movie. And I have Netflix. And if anyone has Netflix knows you can get a streaming video on Netflix besides just getting movies sent to your home. So I clicked on Netflix and streaming video and decided to watch Casablanca on the airplane via Netflix over Wi-Fi. And you know what? It's kind of neat. It worked generally, but it also provided kind of the potential and then also the challenges because, as you would imagine, at times it jittered and it had to buffer and stop and it would slow down. And then, of course, my battery died and it didn't matter one way or the other. So. But I just raised it as an example of, 5 years ago, it's something we might have thought about, and we're just starting now to see these things actually take place. So, with that in mind, I'd like to introduce our panelists. Jeffrey Campbell is a senior director at Cisco. He's going to spend a little time talking about his and Cisco's perspective, and then he's going to show a healthcare demonstration over there, and then we'll go to the other two panelists. The other thing, by the way, as moderator, my job is to be ruthless on time, so if you hear me nudging your foot, I'm not doing my best Larry Craig impersonation. I'm just keeping you along. Thanks.
I'm being ruthless.
Do you have a wide stance, Tom?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I'll stay away from you. I hope you don't have any sticks over there or something. You know, we're all here today to sort of prove why we need better and faster broadband than what we have today. And I think more importantly, demonstrate and prove why the government should care about it and do something about it more than just allowing the ordinary market forces to do so. And so when I was thinking about, you know, how to talk about this, I thought, you know, there's sort of three buckets of things we ought to think about as to why broadband is important. The first is, you know, we ought to look at empirical data. We ought to actually know what the data tells us and figure out this. And a lot of the data on this comes from the past. And so first I'm going to take a moment to run us a little bit through the distant past, which wasn't that long ago. But, you know, a decade ago or so, I was in the PC business, and which at the time was an exciting, profitable, and robust business. You know, every so often there would be, you know, a great innovation, like we could go from a 28.8 modem to a 33.6 modem. And, you know, we think of this today as being a meaningless distinction in speed, but at the time it actually sold machines. People would go and buy a new machine just to get a 33.6 over a 28.8. And when the 56K modems came out, it was, you know, it was great times. And, you know, that tells you how consumer behavior reacts to speed levels. And, you know, then at one point, I think this was in late 1996, the guy who ran the consumer business came to me and he said, there's this great new thing out, it's called ADSL Lite, it's cheap enough, we can put one in every PC we sell. So we're gonna go and get all the phone companies to put DSLAMs in every central office in this country. And in 1997, ADSL will be everywhere in this nation, it'll be the biggest seller we ever had. I looked at him and I said, well, Rod, obviously you don't know anything about telecommunications regulation. Needless to say, that never happened. But it tells you that, you know, increasingly the driver in technology and technological changes from the advent of the internet till now have all been driven and or limited by the speed of the connectivity that we have today. So I think the first empirical thing that we should never forget about this is obvious, but we don't talk about it enough, which was the change from you know, dial-up to broadband. Once we got to broadband, once you had always-on, faster connections, all of a sudden what people could do with the net changed, and we started having all the Web 2.0 applications that people take for granted today, but were never on the vision at the time. I think the other empirical data that's worth looking at is what goes on in corporate networks. Because, you know, corporations usually don't like to waste money, and they usually spend money on useful things and do things. And what you'll notice, most people don't notice this when they go to work and they get on their corporate networks and stuff, but if you ever go down in the corner and look at the icon, you know, of your local area connection and look at the speed that you're connected with, you know, if you go back a while, people were being connected on, you know, 1 megabit, you know, connections around and within their office to communicate with each other and among themselves. Well, then, thanks to the beauty of Ethernet, it went to 10 megabits. Today, most people are on 100 megabits, and there are quite a few systems that are at a gigabit. So if corporations are investing to provide in their internal communications and their internal networks the ability to communicate at those speeds, and they're spending money to do it, there must be a reason that they want to do this, and there must be something that is valuable to this. And I think we need to look at both of these things when we consider whether, I think as Rob put it, 5 megabits is enough and we can all go home right now, and if some people get more, well, so be it, if not others. Well, what is that other thing? Well, this is my second point, which is this is all about video and not the kind of video that Rob was referring to, but how people interact with each other with video, because video changes an entire method of collaboration. For instance, I'll use this conference as an example. We could have had this meeting and discussion as a conference call. You know, we could all get on the conference call, we could all talk, you could all dial in and listen, you could, you know, press a button and ask a question. And so in theory, we could do exactly what we're doing today by that. But we're not. We're here in person, we're sitting in a room, we're looking at each other. You know, the reason for that is that a significant part of communication is visual, not just audio. And the ability to bring that piece into communication greatly enriches the communication and the collaboration for that. So what does that mean for the real world? Well, I'll look to our new president for our priorities here and how to decide that. And I think there are 4 areas that he's focused on right now. One is jobs and the economy. One is education, healthcare, and the environment. These are his priorities. Well, better, faster broadband is key to all 4 of those priorities. The first is it can increase productivity. When I look at what the ability of a system like telepresence, where you can meet with people over a video connection that feels like you're in the same room and have real meetings without traveling, it is an enormous cost saver to business. For instance, at Cisco, we've cut our costs per employee for travel by half since we've deployed telepresence throughout our company, because we just don't travel to meet have internal meetings at the company anymore. We get on telepresence and do it. The second is it's much more efficient. All the time you spend sitting on an airplane flying to California or flying around the world is insane when you can have that 2-hour meeting or that 4-hour meeting in a telepresence session. And thirdly, you can do it on the fly. When you want to meet with somebody who's not where you are, before you'd have to arrange something, think about having a trip, trying to organize other things around it. Now you just do it, get it done, and have it be over with. It's a huge productivity enhancement. And all of these video tools are going to have a great economic boom to the country. But it's more than just about what's good for business. It's also about education, the ability to use distance learning to equalize the resources that we have in our very unequal educational system today. If you can, by the networks and by the internet with very high speed connections, bring the resources from the places that they are to the places that they aren't, you can greatly enrich the educational experience for all the children that are out there. Likewise with healthcare. I think we're going to do a demo on healthcare, so I'm not going to talk about it so much. But the ability to bring resources that are not at the point where people are, particularly specialists and dealing with people in rural areas, which is one of the greatest problems with high-speed broadband, is the ability to give people better, faster, and cheaper healthcare. Lastly, I think, you know, we have to recognize that this is a major environmental benefit here. If we can keep people off of planes when they don't need to be on planes, if people can telecommute, if people can do things electronically rather than physically, we can greatly decrease the carbon footprint of the entire economy, while at the same time, I think, actually providing a better experience both for the people who are working in that economy and for the productivity of the businesses that are in that economy. The last point I'm going to make is more about the future, which is I think we have to look about why do we care so much about very high-speed networks, and what does that mean for us in the long term and in the future. And I think that if this country is going to maintain a position as one of the top economies in the world, we have to be competitive in the fields that are related to broadband. We lead them today, but there is no reason that, you know, we will naturally lead them forever. So it is not by accident, you know, that Google and Yahoo and YouTube and Hulu and all these neat applications that are out there on the web today are built by American companies and are largely American developed technology supporting large numbers of very high paying American jobs here. The reason for that is that broadband came first to the United States. You know, we may be behind other countries today, but when it first came out, it was the U.S. that had the biggest market for it and the fastest adoption of the largest market. And so by being first there, all the people with the great ideas brought them to market in the United States, built the companies in the United States that grew and then became global. Today we face a situation where other countries have better and faster networks than we do. And if we don't do something about it in the long run, the third generation applications, the things that haven't even been thought about yet, that will run on 50 megabit networks and 100 megabit networks, are not going to be developed in the United States because our market will not be able to support those services. They'll be written in other countries, and the Googles of the future will be in Japan or Korea or somewhere where they have the infrastructure to support it. And in the long run, that's a critically important, you know, economic development issue for the country, that we set ourselves in a position that we can continue to grow and maintain the important IT industry. The last point on this, too, also has to do with the potential growth of cloud computing, which may be the next new wave in computing where we have more virtual computing done, rather than everything being done in a discrete box with a set of discrete functions. We use high-speed connections to run them virtually, to store data virtually, to do things virtually. And if that really takes off as a major part of the computing industry, the locations that have the high-speed connections are going to be the ones that benefit from them, and the ones that don't have them will be left behind in a higher cost cul-de-sac that will not be good economically in the long run. So with that, I'm going to stop, and I have an unusual request right now, which is I need a little help from the audience. Is there anybody here who speaks Korean, by any chance?
Priscilla does. Is she out? Priscilla.
Oh, we actually.
Scott, why don't you get?
Okay, we're gonna.
She
well,
speaks Korean.
Does anybody sign ASL? I don't either. But okay. Well, good. We won't have to fall back to Spanish. But we want to move on and do a little demonstration here of the healthcare interpreters network. And my colleague Melinda Paris is going to do a demonstration of this interesting technology that is about dealing with language issues in the healthcare system. What happens when you have a patient who shows up who speaks Korean or who speaks Swahili, and the healthcare providers that are facing them don't speak the language, and you need to know important information from the patient in order to treat them properly? The healthcare interpreters network. Do we have? Oh, wonderful. we have our Korean speaker. Wonderful. And so I'm going to turn it over to Melinda to talk about this.
We're going to be calling into a network of healthcare interpreters that are based in 9 different hospitals in California. At California time, it's really just 7:15. So one by one, the interpreters are all logging in. If we needed something, a language that wasn't available with this group of interpreters, this system would automatically roll to a commercial service provider. We could get Korean 24/7. We could get 170 languages 24/7. But to get the interpreters that are being shared by these hospitals in California, we're going to call Korean right now and see if we can bring
Welcome to the Healthcare Interpreter Network. For Spanish, press 01. For American Sign Language, press 02. For Cantonese, press 03. For Mandarin, press 04. For Vietnamese, press 05. For Korean, press 06. For Hmong, press 07.
Welcome to the Healthcare Interpreter Network. Your call may be monitored or recorded.
It's a call center, so you know you're in. But you didn't know how to say that.
Korean,
Now, if the Korean interpreter only say patients are already logging on in California, but hey, good morning.
Good morning. This is RA902,
can you hear me over there? I'm wondering if you could tell us where you are this morning.
Oh, I'll be happy to. I'm here in California, and don't forget, at the Rancho Los Amigos National Rehabilitation Center.
And, Americans with Disability Act compliance issues, having American Sign Language interpreters available for 24/7 is also really essential. So I'm just going to show you that it's possible. And then we'll sign up. So these are in emergency rooms. 9 to 15 video units are in hospitals, all over the hospital. Telephones are also connected to it, but obviously you can't get the ASL interpreter over the telephone.
Is this used just in California, or?
Actually, a network like this is coming up in Illinois, Sinai Health, University of Illinois. Good morning.
Hello, good morning. My name is Sandra, interpreter number 28609.
All right, thank you very much. We're just doing a test call.
No problem. Have a great day.
Bye-bye. MedStar system in Georgetown University and Washington Medical Center are expected to come up in the next 2 months at the University of New Mexico. All of these networks around the country are now going to be linked up, and they can share interpreters with each other across the country.
All right. So thanks, Jeff and Melinda. And Melinda will be here afterwards, and she'd be happy if you want to test out the system one-on-one and try it out yourself. Should be happy to stay there. Before we go on to the next one, obviously, if you're a foreign-speaking person who goes into a hospital with abdominal pains and is really worried about your health but can't articulate what is exactly wrong with you, you can imagine the security and relief that would feel of being able to know you had a system like that at your hospital. The next person we're going to hear from is Chris Vane, the Chief Information Officer of San Francisco. So thank you very much.
Good morning. Whenever I come to speak about San Francisco, I feel a bit schizophrenic because everybody, and it's true, San Francisco is a hotbed of innovation. We do a lot of amazingly wonderful things in San Francisco, but we also have a problem in San Francisco. We have an incredible digital divide issue, and it really is the foundation for much of what I'm going to talk about today, which is trying to reach all populations within the city and county of San Francisco, regardless of ethnicity, age, or educational attributes. It was about 6 years ago that Mayor Gavin Newsom made his revolutionary call for free Wi-Fi services within the city and county of San Francisco. A lot has happened since that call was made, but what has happened in the city and county of San Francisco is that we've developed a project called Project Tech Connect, where we are focusing on broadband access, bringing the computers, the equipment to access that network, to build unique programming on top of that network, and do training and support. And what I'm here to talk about today is much of what is described in the report is actually happening in San Francisco in pilot projects. And I want to talk about three pilot projects this morning. The first is our network of community networks. We have 5,000 units of Federal Housing Authority in San Francisco. I am about to connect all 5,000 units in San Francisco using fiber and Wi-Fi. And for the roughly 2,500 units I have connected to date, we are experiencing speeds of 30 to 110 in the most disadvantaged portions of the city. What we're doing with that speed is creating educational opportunities, health opportunities, community development opportunities, and seeing the impact with the populations that are being served. For example, we have now classes going on in these housing authority units where elderly are being taught in three languages using much of the technology that you've just seen on how to improve their computer literacy skills. We have community health organizations and community development organizations using these centers to actually teach and train all of their respective populations. We are moving toward the healthcare arena and a pilot project where we have patients in the Tenderloin with a specific issue, HIV/AIDS, and we are connecting those patients to the Department of Public Health, General Hospital, and potentially to the university system, and we are actually treating those patients using the network, and again, using the video technology, we are doing the interpretation for those individuals right then and there. And as is being reported by the doctors and the patients, treatment has been dramatically improved for those populations. In the education arena, I am connecting to a new museum, California Academy of Sciences, one of the greenest buildings in the country. California Academy of Sciences is wildly successful, but they can't reach all of the populations they want to because they are so wildly successful. So using our fiber network, connecting that museum to the Boys and Girls Club in one of our most disadvantaged areas, we are bringing the curriculum, the experience of that museum directly to the kids in these disadvantaged areas. And we're about to create an international communication opportunity with students in Amsterdam through the Connected Urban Development Project so that these kids in these disadvantaged areas can focus on the global environmental disaster and figure out ways that they can help within their neighborhood and come up with creative ideas using video from NASA, using video from the California Academy of Sciences and others to create an amazing game, if you will, because let's face it, that's how young people learn these days, through gaming. And we're going to be able to share that with students in Amsterdam to get their input, because they're going to be doing the same thing, and create more global understanding and communication around this issue. So those are just three examples of what we're doing in San Francisco. It's been an amazing time. I could talk for hours about what we're doing in the government, about video streaming through our fiber network, but the point of all of this is that it really requires broadband access in speeds from 30 to 110 to really enable this kind of capability and this kind of experience within a city and county. And I keep emphasizing city and county because we in San Francisco do the normal city things, but we also are in charge of public health, human services, all of those traditional county organization requirements. And as we build these pilot projects out in neighborhoods, we're going to be able to prove, because we now have baseline information, we have actually gone out to all of the neighborhoods within the city and county of San Francisco and understand broadband penetration, educational levels, access to computers. We've got all of that. And now what we're doing is using that baseline data, comparing the impact of these pilot projects using wireless and wired broadband. And we hope to be able to come back to you with real data to show the impact of what we're able to accomplish in the city and county of San Francisco with this technology. And hopefully make an impact at the NTIA and stimulus package and all that kind of stuff too, but that goes beside the point. So anyway, it's been a pleasure with you to be with you this morning, and and being reminded that there was something that when Stephen and I, he interviewed me over the phone several weeks ago about what we're doing in San Francisco. There is a part of San Francisco that is very important to the economy, and that's the digital media companies that reside and work in San Francisco. And several years ago, when they were building some of their big plants, they came to me and they begged me to provide my municipal fiber to their offices, because without that, at the time, they were unable to do the video production work that they needed to do, and they were having to send it overseas to be completed and then, you know, have it sent back. It was frustrating for me because I had this capability of 10 to 110, and that's what they needed, but I couldn't give it to them because it's a municipal network. It's not made for for-profit endeavors. And so they have done what they needed to do, and they've been wildly successful, but it has been a large impediment, from what I'm being told, to their business model for not having that broadband fiber connection. I'm hoping that what I can do with the results of these pilot projects actually develop such a system that will allow those types of companies to not have to rely on other forms of broadband, but actually provide it for them and to them, and keep all of that production activity in the city and county of San Francisco. Anyway, thank you very much.
Our last panelist is John Windhausen from Telepoli Consulting.
Thank you, Tom. And thank you, and thanks to Rob. Special congratulations to Stephen for putting together what's really a fabulous report. I really commend both of you for putting this together. And what strikes me about the report, if you haven't had a chance to read it yet, and probably not because it's just being released today, is that for a long time, folks like me and lots of others have talked about the applications that could be used over broadband in a kind of theoretical sense. And look at all these wonderful telemedicine applications and telework applications and distance learning applications. Well, they've actually gone the next step and gone out to the field and found those applications that are in existence today and that are being offered today over specific networks as living proof. So in other words, this is not just fantasy anymore. This is not just a dream world. This is actual experience that we now have to draw upon. And you know, as I'm going around the country giving some talks about the broadband stimulus bill, I'm going to have two primary sources for my speeches from now on. First, it's quotes from Yogi Berra, and second, it's going to be this report because it's going to be that useful going forward. So I commend that to you, and it's difficult to find much to disagree with in the report, and in fact, I don't. But I can pull out a couple of things that may warrant a little bit of attention. And one of the things is that a lot of the examples that have been talked about by all of these panelists, it's interesting to see how many of these were started in the academic arena and how many of them were started by universities. Now, I do some consulting for EDUCAUSE and Internet2 and the American Library Association, so I should give you that disclaimer. But nevertheless, if you look at, for instance, we now know that Al Gore didn't invent the internet, but the universities did. And they did so under contract to the Department of Defense. It came up with the original protocols. But it's been much more than the internet. It's been the NSFNet. It's been a lot of the, what we now regard as commonplace, a lot of the underpinnings of Google and Facebook, cloud computing, many, many examples. Telemedicine, a lot of that research and applications are originate at the universities because they house the leading medical centers on the university campuses. So it's in large part the universities that are driving the innovations that are then becoming transferred into the private sector and into the marketplace. And so recognizing that is, I think, is a key component of the need for what we do for the future, because ideally what we're talking about, and I think what's great about this paper, is that it's not looking at broadband applications in a static way. It's looking at it in a futuristic way, but realistic way, and it's pushing the edge of the envelope to see what else we can accomplish, what new things can we put out there. And a lot of those new things are right now being done in the university laboratories, and they need the financial support in order to be able to continue to do that work. So one of the great things and really visionary things about the legislation that Congress just passed was that the funding, particularly for the NTIA, goes not just to unserved areas but also underserved. And that's a key component of the legislation, which I think is a real victory, because it allows them what NTIA will need to do in evaluating the grants is not just look at whether you have broadband or not in kind of a binary system of off and on. It's not just that. It's also by looking at underserved. You then get a chance to look at, okay, what are the capabilities, the broadband capabilities, compared to the demand and the uses? And that allows folks like universities and also libraries to be eligible for this funding. And if I could just explain the need for libraries, I don't have to say too much about it, because I think it's become more commonly known now. There was a front page story in the Wall Street Journal and a front page story in the Washington Post over the last couple months talking about the huge demand for use of library services. And this is not so much high-end uses as just enormous need for real basic information. It's people going to the libraries because you can get free access. It's in some way, although free is probably not the right word, somebody described it probably more accurately as prepaid. You know, you've paid for the library through your tax services, and they make free Wi-Fi services available for job applications and for applying for government benefits. And so the libraries are looking at an incredible amount of demand. It's kind of the Walmart effect in this economic recession. More and more people are streaming to lower cost alternatives, and so the libraries are becoming great centers for the community and resources for the community. They really need a fiber connection, and most libraries don't have even a T1. But if they could get a fiber connection, that would provide much more value to the community, and I think is something that we ought to acknowledge. One thing about the report, it talks about all these great technologies and the great speeds that are being rolled out, and that's all wonderful thing. It's a little odd. At the beginning of the report, it talks about the speeds that we need being in the nature of 50 megabits per second. And I think that may fall a little short of what we ultimately are going to be needing. Now, we put out a report, a blueprint for big broadband about a year ago, calling for 100 megabits. Even the 100 megabits threshold is sort of a floor, but really is the minimum for what we're going to need in the future. And I think we need to grow to that, to level and beyond. I can use my wife as an example, if you don't mind. She runs a small business. She runs a music school. She is not a technologist whatsoever. But she is all enthusiastic now about putting videos of piano recitals on her website, and now an avatar that it can explain to consumers the benefits of getting a musical education. Now, she's a very small business, but what that means is more and more small businesses, not large businesses, but more and more small businesses are going to see the need for video applications on a routine basis. So all the things that we talk about today, sort of futuristic, they are becoming more and more commonplace, just as Jeff talked about what used to be a 56K modem was a big advancement. Now that's nothing. We're going to continue to grow. We don't see an end in sight for the growth of this future capacity. So I would just close by saying, hopefully we're at the beginning of this and not at the end. That Rob's earlier papers have talked quite a bit about what Sweden has done and what Japan and Korea have done to invest in their public broadband. And up until now, the United States, it's really been an embarrassment that the United States has not stepped forward. Now we have. And the stimulus package is a good step in the right direction. So we're no longer an embarrassment, but it is still woefully insufficient. I mean, if you just look what's happened over the last few months, where Australia has announced, to compare, the United States has awarded $7.2 billion in the stimulus bill for broadband. Now, compare that to the fact that Australia just announced a $4.7 billion
$1 billion program for broadband in Australia. Greece, just about a month ago, announced $2.7 billion. New Zealand, $1.5 billion. These are newer developments of countries who are putting up comparable amounts of money as the United States, and yet their economies are probably, what, less than one-tenth the size of the United States? So I'm very hopeful that we see this stimulus bill as the first step, and Blair Levin and others who helped to draft that have talked about this being the first inning of a nine-inning game. I think we really, I'm optimistic that this administration, and based upon the good work that Rob and Steve are doing, are going to continue to push the envelope forward, because we really need to keep the ball moving forward if the applications that they're talking about here now can really become a reality. Thank you.
Thank you, John. We're going to do a couple questions from up here, and then we're going to open it up to the audience, so feel free, you know, start to think about the questions you want to ask. Based on where John ended, which was great in look in terms of looking at some national strategies, I thought maybe we could kick it off by any of the panelists who want to. The FCC, by law now, is required to come back with a broadband plan, I think within 12 months. What are the key fundamentals in that plan to accomplish what you're talking about when you're looking at competitiveness with other countries? So why don't we kick it off to anyone who wants to answer that question. Rob, do you want to start, or you want to kick it off?
Key fundamentals. I mean, we've always written that there are three challenges. There's the unserved, there's the people who could get broadband but don't. These are people Chris is working with now. And there's a speed challenge, and I think we have to look at these as separate and distinct challenges. They're not the same, they don't require the same policy solutions. If you think about the speed solution, I think we've got to, frankly, bite the bullet and do what these other countries have done, which is use tax policy. That's what the Koreans have done, that's what the Japanese have done. It seems strange to me that we're not letting companies depreciate assets that are supposedly very long-term assets, but we're not giving them an incentive to do that. So I would do that. I know that's not everybody in this field agrees with that, but I do think it's similar to the R&D tax credit. We have an R&D tax credit because we economists recognize there are externalities that companies don't get from their R&D, so they underinvest in R&D. There are externalities that companies and individuals do not get from deploying or subscribing to high-speed broadband. I think economic policy needs to reflect that.
Jeff, you look like you wanted to speak up.
Yeah, I think Rob hit the three categories, and I think they all have to be addressed separately, but I also think that within those categories, we have to set out specific goals of what we intend to accomplish and over what time period we intend to accomplish those goals. And on certain things, like, you know, speed levels, those numbers are going to have to go up over time because the technology is going to continue to develop. We can't just set, you know, one goal, meet it at some point in time, and declare that the problem is solved. This is going to be something we're going to have to work with over time. And likewise, in areas of adoption, you know, we should set up goals over time and how we get to, you know, universal adoption of the technology in society as well. It's going to take a long time, so we need both near-term goals that we can meet in realistic times, but long-term goals that are where we need to be at the end of the day.
John, did you want to jump in?
I'd just like to add that almost every other country that has succeeded in advancing the ball in broadband deployment has had a plan. In fact, most of these other countries adopted plans almost a decade ago, in the 2000-2001 timeframe. So it's really about time for the United States to step forward and do that. Glad to see that that's being done. The only thing that's a little odd is that it's the FCC that's doing that. Because ideally what we want is integrated policy that will carry across the entire United States government and state governments and local governments as well. Up until now, what we've seen is the U.S. broadband policy, if there is one, has been sort of set by litigation and by rulemakings at the FCC, you know, particular proceedings about how do you treat open access for the 700 megahertz spectrum, or should fiber be subject to unbundling rules or not, and kind of a case-by-case approach. And there hasn't been an overall theme and comprehensive look at it. So, I mean, I think it's a very positive step that the legislation took to get going, and let's hope it looks that the FCC is capable of looking outside of just its individual proceedings before it and look at the big picture.
Great. Chris, you said you wanted to...
From my perspective, and I guess from the consumer perspective, I would add to your list price and availability. I think that markets, private sector vendors are coming up with alternatives and opportunities for broadband, but at prices that not everyone can afford because of the price point itself, so by the way, so I think we need to ensure that pricing and availability is added to the discussion around policy.
Great. Jeff, I'm going to put you on the spot for a second, if you don't mind. A lot of times the focus, and I even used an example of a movie, the focus on broadband is on movies and games, which would not jump out as the single most important thing policymakers would have to worry about. Why should government get involved? And two, how do you relay the importance to policymakers, if indeed it is important, on the need for speed?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's sometimes difficult when we see internet applications that sort of blend into each other. I think of one past example is instant messaging, you know, which started out kind of as this AOL chat thing where teenagers were talking to each other so that they could, you know, type instead of having their parents overhear them or something like that, which is really why I think it caught on. Which today is now a big corporate tool. Everybody uses it at the office. You know, you're on a conference call, you're IMing with someone, you're emailing, you're doing all these things at once. And what started as a consumer application actually became, you know, a business tool that's useful. Video is in some ways the same way. You know, at a low level, you know, there are, you know, business and economic and social benefits of being able to broadcast video, like doing something like the zoo visit, where you can broadcast something back to people that they can't see themselves. But we also forget about the collaborative part of video, which is really what this is about. It's not about entertainment. It's about the ability to communicate in a better, richer way without traveling. It's a way to reach larger numbers of people more forcefully, so that you can, you know, video blog instead of, you know, do written blog. It's a much richer way of communicating, and that's going to have huge economic impacts in terms of worker productivity. And it's also going to have enormous social impacts, because we can do much more with government programs and the same amount of money that is being spent more effectively in areas like healthcare, like we just saw demonstrated here today, or in education. So we can make dollars stretch further. And that's the kind of video that matters, not, you know, whether you're getting the Disney Channel or not, as much as people might value the Disney Channel. The government needs to care about whether you can get the educational channel to your school so that your kids can learn Mandarin, whereas before there was no Mandarin-speaking teacher in that school and available.
Stephen, you wanted to jump in?
Well, you know, in terms of convincing policymakers of the need for speed and faster broadband networks in the United States, I think events like this are a very important part of it. I mean, the key message is that this is not about, you know, watching YouTube videos faster, but this is about fundamentally transformative applications that, when we think creatively and we look to design solutions for these very pressing social challenges, that the applications that can run on next generation broadband networks are going to be key to addressing some of these education, healthcare, environmental, and transportation challenges.
Great. Now we're going to open up to the audience, and I think I see someone who wants to ask a question. If you could introduce yourself and then say your question robustly.
I'm Gary Bahula from Internet 2, and I actually have just a comment on one of Stephen's examples, one of the slides. I saw the slide of the doctor with a baby talking to some colleagues. And the story behind that, that's from Ohio, and there's a relationship between a prime neonatal center in Columbus and a small rural hospital about 80 miles away. And they now have this very high-speed video link. The end equipment costs about $10,000 each, so it's not very expensive. In the old days, when a child was born at that rural hospital and there was any problem whatsoever, a phone call would get made to the neonatal center, and the answer 99% of the time was put the child on a helicopter and send it here. Now, since they've been using this for over 2 years, they examine the child remotely. They consult with the doctors in the rural hospital. They look at the child with the video, and they have reduced the helicopter trips by 50%. The family gets to stay with those children at the rural hospital. The rural hospital doctors are learning from their urban colleagues. The urban hospital is no longer have to take cases that essentially really shouldn't be there. And you save $5,000 per helicopter trip for all of us that are paying health insurance premiums. So this kind of stuff is going to take big investment, but the payoff is enormous.
Great. You have a question? Yeah.
Any I would just add on that, by the way, there's a report we did last October called Digital Quality of Life. It's on our website on the homepage on the bottom. If you go to the education chapter, there's a fairly comprehensive review of most of the literature on the educational outcomes of IT, and including broadband.
Gentlemen there.
Hi, my name is Bruce Langer. I'm from the Columbia Institute for Telecommunication. Would anyone like to talk about the correlation between advanced information technologies and jumpstarting the green economy?
Sure, I'll take this forward. I think that broadband and information technologies are going to turn out to be one of the key things we need to do to deal with alternative energy and with energy efficiency as well. Part of it is that energy efficiency is largely a matter of control, and whether you can control systems, can you power something down when it's not being used? Can you remotely, on simple levels, can I turn my thermostat down at home when I'm not at home, or turn it up in the summer, and use less energy when I don't need to do it? Do I have the systems to do that? Can utilities manage their energy transmission in a way that they can bring renewable sources of energy from where they are produced to where the consumers are actually going to consume them? All of this is going to require a lot of what I would call control. And the control is going to be brought about by IT systems and broadband networks. And so if we don't have them, we're not going to be able to fully implement what we're going to need to do in the energy situation going forward.
Stephen would like to show.
I'd also point out, as you read the report, you'll find other examples of how broadband supports smart appliances, smart homes, smart buildings that I didn't have time to introduce in the conversation. But to answer your question specifically as well, you'll find about this on page 15 of the report. And we cite recent research that has found that if all Americans had fiber to the home, this would contribute to a 5% reduction in gasoline use, a 4% reduction in carbon dioxide emissions, $5 billion in lowered road expenditures, and $1.5 billion commuter hours were captured. So page 15 of the report, I'll show you more about that.
I promise this gentleman next. That's right.
Jeff Daly, AppRoxen.com. One of a quick comment and a question for the panel. Comment being that, picking up on Jeff's thread, that this is really all about video, and then Stephen's thread that the networks we have today can't support HD video, but that HD video is not the end game. There's Ultra HD video, and it's 16 times the resolution of regular HD video. What that's going to enable, and we're not looking too far in the future here, Japan's made it their broadcast standard by 2012, is within the next 10 years, we're going to be able to print screens like paper. So your computer is going to be that wall. You're going to touch a button, and it's going to show up as if it was like you're standing right next to it. And to do that, you need the Ultra HD video. To deliver one Ultra HD video stream today, you need 120 megabits per second. So to turn on the TV, you're going to need more than 100 megabits per second, which is why I'm a believer we need to get that next generation broadband. The question then is, considering that broadband is infrastructure and needs to be thought of as a long-term investment, how should that influence and shape the decisions the NTIA and RUS are making regarding the kinds of broadband projects they should be funding? Should they be funding kind of current generation broadband, or do we need to be focusing on next generation broadband?
John, do you want to take a stab at that?
I think the way you phrased the question is obvious. They should be focused on next generation broadband, absolutely. That's where you're going to get the best bang for your buck in the long term. There's a great quote from, I think it's Mr. Yassin, who is known as the father of the cable modem, and he is patting himself and the industry on the back for saying this is such cable modem technology is so great that this could last for 6, 7, or 8 years. that is not the kind of mindset that we want going into these grant proposals and these grant decisions. We should be looking at installing infrastructure that are going to last for decades.
Let me add to that. I think this is a really critical question about how we think about stimulus, and I, unfortunately, this is not really the panel that is going to be able to do that, although, John, we should, at some point, somebody should organize a dialogue on that, because I think it's a very complicated question. I agree with John's point about next gen and upgrade for libraries and schools and things like that. I think, though, the problem is that if we were doing what the Irish did, which was essentially $23 billion, or Australia's probably equivalent to probably $40 billion or $50 billion on a per capita basis,
right,
then I think we'd have enough resources to do all of what we want. But I worry that we don't have enough resources to do all of what we want. And so in some ways, I think, given that it's a frankly, you know, not very much money, my thought is we should focus most of it on just getting people who don't have any access to the network today, rural network, and get them as good a network as economically feasible. But the real goal should be to get as many people, with then some upgrades to existing like libraries, community centers, community colleges. I don't think, frankly, we have enough money to start saying we want to get really high-speed networks and people who already have it. We didn't do a big enough stimulus there. So that's my take on it.
Chris, did you want to jump in?
One thing I think we have to consider in that, I think Rob makes a point that, you know, there are people who have nothing, and we do have to think about giving them something. But as we're doing so, we also should be thinking about what is the future of what we're giving them. Because, you know, some methods of providing it could turn out to be dead-end technologies, which gives them something, but will never give them anything more than that. And so I think a factor that has to be considered is the upgradability prospects for this, because we all know that if we give somebody 5 megabits today and then they're never going to get anything more, 5 years from now we're going to be looking at the fact that they need 50, and what we paid for is in the past is not going to be useful for the future. So there has to be a balance between the two things here.
Obviously, representing San Francisco, while I hear your point about rural, I'm from North Dakota, I understand rural, but I also understand that cities have needs as well, and the penetration, price, availability is a huge issue for most major cities. It certainly is for San Francisco. So I think we need to be fair about how that money is allocated for rural and for urban areas. And I think the second point I'd like to make about how the rules get made, I think that you're right, there's not enough money in the bill to do everything. So what we need to be doing is looking at pilot projects or test cases that are able to be created and replicated from somebody who's got some money and who can cobble it together and make it happen to those that may not be able to and build on whatever speed that they're going to get. So I think those kinds of things are absolutely important to making this money go as far as it needs to go.
Isn't Golden Gate Park rural?
It's good to see you're all in agreement. You had a question?
Yes, my name is Christina Speck. I work for NTIA's international office. I think that the comments that Jeff Sisko just made are actually interesting enough that they could probably form a panel in and of itself. I've been at NTIA for almost 10 years, following broadband and other issues. Working actively in the OECD, where we've looked at the particular context of Korea and Japan, where there are a lot of, you know, reasons why they are. There's also a lot of issues about what's actual speed versus advertised speed. So a lot of these issues, delving into them will be of more interest. I need to look closer at what's in this specific report, but could actually probably be a good idea for another panel in terms of, you know, what you give them now, where it can go, and what it could evolve. I personally have not felt comfortable for a long time with the term next generation and what that actually means. But I had an experience, a personal experience last night, where I had a laptop that broke, and I use free wireless Wi-Fi access at home, and I had a laptop arrive from Amazon.com last night that now works on 802.11n, one of the new Wi-Fi standards. And I logged on, and, you know, I work at the Commerce Department, so I got fast access there. And the difference in what I was able to do last night with that wireless standard and what I was doing with a totally comparable laptop was tremendous. I mean, I saved so much time, and the speed was just astounding. So I think, I don't know if the report goes into wireless as well as wired. I think that's an important component.
To some degree,
obviously,
yes.
You know, the wireless goes into the wired network at some point, so we shouldn't pay them discreetly. But I think these types of issues would actually be worthy of another panel if ITIF would be willing to host. And also, this whole terminology, next generation, I think at some point we have to figure out another way to define what we're talking about. Because in a lot of the categories in parts of the country, we're not there, or we are there, maybe not to our satisfaction. But maybe develop new terminology would help also the debate. Finally, also, we're having a public meeting on March 10th. If anybody wants more information on that, I'd be happy to provide it.
Chris, did you want to jump in?
I can't agree more. Obviously, Wi-Fi is a very important technology for the city and county of San Francisco, and we are working with a company called Meraki. They are going to be unveiling the antenna that will handle Gator 2, and it's going to be a tremendous boom to an organic growth of Wi-Fi. I think we have about 250,000 people now covered through this system in the city and county of San Francisco. And back to the green question, they're also developing solar-powered antenna that will be able to be done in. So we're definitely moving into that arena, and I would love to share. I've got all kinds of stories to talk about.
Yeah, what was interesting to me was I was actually going to buy the same laptop I had, and Amazon.com has a 1-800 number where you get it for free. And he talked me into buying another model, Asus, specifically because of this capability. And being a woman and liking the blue laptop that I had, I actually talked to him. He had to talk me through the sale, and he told me about the speed, and it's true. It really made me.
This gentleman's been very patient.
Valor Hurst, and the chairman of the U.S. Broadband Coalition. I haven't had time to read the report, but I can see ideally 15 megabits per second. Or upwards, and I can see the headlines. ITIF says 50 megs is ideal, but it isn't. The example you gave is fiber to the home and what it would empower. The discussion here has been about households that would easily blow past 50 megs per second. Could you elaborate a little bit more on what that figure is and what it isn't?
Yeah, I mean, Jim, I'm chairing this National Commission on Transportation Finance. We just released a report last week, and we called for a 10-cent gas tax increase, and everybody's freaking out. I'm like, why didn't you call for a 40-cent gas tax increase? Because we would have been even more freaking people out, and people were laughing at us. So, yeah, 100 meg is really nice, but at some point we wanted to be a little bit pragmatic and say that you know, we shouldn't have the perfect be the enemy of the good, and to some extent, if we get, this is to Jeff's point, I mean, Verizon, just to use them as an example, I get 20 meg to my home, I guess I could buy 50 from them, and they're rolling, they're upgrading us to the GPON at some point, Link, and we'll be able to get me higher speed. So I see it as somewhat incremental if we're getting the technology out there that gets us close to that, and then we got to keep on going. So we're not saying 50 is the end game.
But Rob, what is 50? Is it a national average where you add up all of the...
No, 50, we don't see that as an average. We see that as every home should have 50.
Hey, Jeff.
It's also, you know, if you look at where the countries we're comparing ourselves to, that's generally the range where some of them are getting to these days. Look, you know, I'd love to have a gigabit to my house, and Link, I'm going to find out when I can. Being in the district.
Tell me I can use a gigabit.
Underground utilities in the district, it's going to take a while. But I think there is a point about understanding where we need to get. We need to get to 100 and beyond. But there's also about what's really great today. The fact is right now I get 2.7 at home. And that's fine. But I would love to get to 10, and 50 would be fantastic. And so I think we have to recognize that it's a progression, and that in different locations the progression is going to move faster and slower. And I think as a policy matter, what we want the government to do is to make sure that the places where it's going slower, we have good policy that encourages that to go faster. Because it's always going to be moving to.
So is it for today? Is it for tomorrow?
I'm going to try and get as many questions as we came here.
Hi, I'm John Blair. I'm a freelance writer. I think this is an absolutely critical question. What is our goal, and what should the tactics be to get there? And we have excellent points on both sides, isn't it? But I think one way to look at this is that to look 5 to 10 years out, do we want to go through the process of connected nation, that is, bringing our present broadband to everyone, everywhere, and at the end of 6, 7, 8 years, end up with 5, 10 megabit broadband? Or do we want to get
broadband, our present broadband, to those without it now, but then immediately switch to fiber, to high-speed broadband, because that's where we want to be at the end of this very long process to build out the network.
I think you...
But I say again, this is, you know, economically, politically, technically, it's a tough issue, but this is the one we should be focused on. And Rob's point is exactly right. Are we talking about the, best being the enemy of the good?
Yeah, I think it's a good comment and goes to your point about another panel.
Let me make one just quick point. By the way, if you haven't read your book, you should, have you read your book out yet?
End
coming
of,
out yet?
End of the month.
All right, I've seen the galleys, so it's a wonderful galley to read the book. The point, I guess, I think we just have to be careful that while I love fiber and I get it, we really do need to be technology agnostic. Any company that can provide 100 or more, whether it's wired, whether it's cable, DOCSIS 3 or DOCSIS 9, whatever, DOCSIS 25, or fiber through a telecom or wireless, we just need to be getting there.
You had a question.
Yeah, Philip Weber, Congressional Budget Office. To shift the discussion completely, I was interested in Mr. Campbell's example of how Cisco has replaced flying around with these virtual meetings. Is the capacity substantially like that? Are they very different? Could you describe to me how it's used internally, a little bit about the technology?
Sure. The technology is called telepresence, which we make, but other companies make as well. And essentially, it's like a virtual conference room. So if you come to my office on Pennsylvania Avenue, you can walk into the telepresence room, and you have half of the table, the chairs, and then on the other half, you have three double the quality of high definition TV video screens and three cameras. And when you connect, it connects just like a voice over IP phone. In fact, you just press the button on the voice over IP phone. And it connects. It requires about 12 to 15 megabits of connectivity in both directions in a very highly managed network to make sure you get the quality. So you can see, I can see people on a telepresence screen in higher quality than I can see you sitting in your chair right now because they're physically closer. So you can see sweat on people's forehead. The audio is spatial.
During budget meetings.
So when I talk from where I'm sitting at the table, people hear it coming from that direction. And it's as close as you can get to being in the room without being in the room. And essentially what we've done, we've deployed over 300 of these throughout our company in various locations. And we've said, you don't need to travel for internal meetings anymore. Stop it. And use them. And they're intensely used. In fact, the hardest part is scheduling them because somebody always wants to use the room when you want to use it. But it eliminates an enormous amount of travel, hundreds of millions of dollars of the company. And as more companies and governments and businesses adopt it, it's totally interoperable because it runs on the SIP protocol like voice over IP. So, you have it at your office now, Lynn?
No, we got it up.
It's coming. I can talk to Verizon over it, or if the government gets it, I can talk to the government over it. It's going to be just like an interoperable system.
We have time for one more question, this gentleman there, and then we're going to turn it over to Rob for some closing remarks.
Yes, this is Steve Posey. I'm with the American Consumer Institute. About 40% of consumers aren't online in their residence, and my question is really for Chris, I guess. In your project, do you provide computers and computer training to those 5,000 units?
There's a big discussion about bringing IT home, which is one economy's deal, where every person should have a computer in their home versus doing it in a group and having people use it in a group education fashion. I like both ideas. It really just comes down to money. So what we're doing is building those centers within the housing authority units so people can have joint learning. We are also refurbishing computers and either at low cost or no cost, providing them to the disadvantaged. And we've also worked with manufacturers to bring costs down. They can buy, the disadvantaged folks can buy new computers, and we've worked with financing organizations like credit unions to provide low cost loans. So we're doing it all to see what is the best way to do it.
I would also add, Chris is, they have a program there that I think is one of the best programs in the country. I can't remember the name of the woman who runs that, but it's the Community Technology Center program. and it's an excellent program. I encourage you to look at it if you're interested in good models. So let me just close by saying that I think, you know, in 5 years we probably won't be having this conversation, or at some point I hope there will be a period when we're not having this anymore, because we will just have this. It's like we don't have a conversation that says, you know, we need a good phone network. You know, we have a good phone network. We need to get to that point. And the problem is we're in this transitional period from essentially going from a good phone network to a really good or great data network, i.e. broadband. And so at some point we will be able to claim credit claim success and go home. But we're a long, long way away from that, and it's going to take a lot of effort by the private sector, by cities, by community groups, and perhaps most importantly by the federal government to develop and articulate and implement a vision. One last thing I'll say is I do think we just released a report last week where we benchmarked the U.S. against 39 other countries on a whole set of indicators, and what we found was that the U.S. was, besides being sixth, not number one, the U.S. was 40th in progress. There was no other country that had made less progress than us on a whole set of innovation-based competitive metrics. And so if we're going to succeed in the future, we've got to have innovation be at the center of our economic policy. This is a core component of that. And if we do that, I think, as going to Jeff's point, we'll see significant increases in productivity. We'll also see significant increases in jobs. We estimate in the report that doing this, getting to this vision, would create 2 million jobs, 2 million man-year or person-year jobs. So it would not only just create jobs, but it would create a whole set of new economic business opportunities and productivity and efficiency on top of that. So with that, please join me in thanking Tom, thanking great panelists, and they'll be around for a few minutes.